So welcome again to our Torah class, Parshat Ki Tetzeh 5784, 9/11, We Must Never Forget. And again, this is the next installment in our Kollel Aharon Velea series. We want to dedicate the class, the learning, should be an aliyah, should be an elevation for all of those 3,000 wonderful souls who died on 9/11, 23 years ago. It's hard to believe. So at the outset, what I would like to do is explore the idea of memory with you, but through the prism of our Parsha this week, our Torah reading, and also through the prism of an earlier account of the same event. So we know that, and I've spoken about this in the past, newspapers of old, of yesteryear, used to be famous for being very particular about the reporting, the news gathering pages, and only editorialized on the editor's page. You had the opinion, perhaps, of the editors of the paper. Then you would have an opposing position, what's called an op-ed. And then maybe the letters to the editor would be there on that page. But except for that one unique page, any purebred newspaper person would never deign to mix, to mish, as they say in Yiddish, the editorial comment with the reporting of the basic news. It was for you to decide what it meant to you, not for the paper to preach to you or to play with the narrative. Sadly, of course, that does not exist today, but I'm proud to say it exists in the time of the Torah, because in the Torah we have four books, the first four books of our Torah, which begin and end with the story of the Jewish people on the precipice of the land of Canaan, of the land of Israel. It ends the book of Numbers, the Midbar. And then you have a very unique book, the fifth book, Deuteronomy, Devarim, which we are currently reading from. And this book is Mishnah Torah. It's a repetition that encapsulates many, but not all, of the historical biblical commandments that were in the other four. But it does it from the God perspective, through the eyes of Moshe, Moshe Rabbeinu of Moses. And so it's unique. So these two sections right here, the first one from Exodus 17 is an account of the actual events that transpired in the unprovoked Amalekite attack against the Jewish people as we, the Jewish people, were leaving Mitzrayim, Egypt. We were journeying forth to Sinai to get the Torah. And then the last account, which is the second on your Mara Makomot, I only put two sources here to make it easy. The second is from this week's Torah reading, Devarim, Deuteronomy 25. Three lines which give us a distinctly different vantage point. I remember once years ago I drew a Venn diagram, and I went through the verses from Exodus 17 and then Deuteronomy 25. And I had one group of my students, my Talmidim, who were assigned Exodus 17, and they wrote the main points of that narrative. And then the other group was in charge of Deuteronomy 25. And then in a Venn diagram, you're supposed to have in the middle the meeting points, the points that are in common. And that Venn diagram had nothing in the middle. So I asked the students, well, what could this mean if there's no meeting place? So they didn't really have a good answer, but I believe the very simple answer is one is informational and one is educational. One is the reporting, the news gathering, and one is the editorial slant from God, what it means to us. So I will read for you now from the beginning of source number one, just very, very quickly. He named the place Massa, testing and Meribah, quarreling, because of the quarrel of the children of Israel and because of their testing of the Lord, saying, is the Lord in our midst or not? So the Jewish people were very upset. They kvetched. They complained against God. And this is the story of when Moses hits the rock. Not a good moment in Jewish history, especially not for Moshe. And as a result of that, the kvetch, the complaint, the Jewish people are given the answer from God. You dare ask, is God in our midst or not? You know what my response is? Amalek is coming. The biblical nation that is destined to provoke and to challenge the Jewish people throughout eternity. And Amalek arrives. And again, I'll go through this very quickly. Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. That was the site, the location of where the Jewish people were camped. And then it goes on to tell us about how Moses tells Joshua, you go get the army ready. I will go up and pray on behalf of you overlooking the battle array. And while Joshua fights, Moses, Aaron, and Hur are up on the mountain overlooking the battle array, and they pray to God. And Moses has his hands extended towards God. And when the people were languishing in their military battle, because this is like the first military battle in Jewish history, they are newly, should we say, expunged slaves that have been emancipated just a few days earlier. So they didn't really have any great technology or battle skills. So they were kind of getting a little forlorn. They look at Moses, and Moses is up there engaged with God. Please, God, help us. We win the day. But we don't eliminate all of Amalek that day, just part of Amalek that existed in that generation. So that is the long and short of this story. But then it ends with the following. Listen to this. Last line. And he said, for there is a hand on the throne of the Eternal, meaning God, that there shall be a war for the Lord against Amalek, Midor, from generation to generation. And what that tells us is kind of scary. In every generation, there will be an entity known as Amalek that potentially will be there to challenge, perhaps persecute, and perhaps even destroy the Jewish people. That is an eternal battle. And then look at source number two, and now we're going to try to understand what the meaning of that battle was, what motivated Amalek, a little bit more of the editorial slant. You shall remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you went out of Egypt, how he chanced upon you on the way and cut off all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary. And he, Amalek, did not fear God. Therefore, it will be when the Lord your God grants you respite from all your enemies around you in the land which the Lord your God gives to you as an inheritance to possess, that you shall obliterate the remembrance of Amalek from beneath the heavens. You shall not forget. So this gives us everything we need to know about Amalek. The MO, the modus operandi of Amalek, the intent of Amalek is told in the word how he happened upon you. Things happen. So what was Amalek's intent? You Jewish people, you think you're so hot. You're such hot stuff. Yeah, God vanquished Pharaoh and the 10 plagues, and you walked through the sea, and it was magnificent. And you think this is all destiny. Hashgacha, destiny. I'm going to show you, Amalek said, a spin. And he spun the events for us. And he said, you know, you think this is all destiny? You lucked out. Good, new. Things happen, and you won the day. It will not always be that way, and I'll show you. Because I'm going to have the audacity, the chutzpah, to take you on when you are surrounded by God's anenei hakavod, these seven clouds of glory that are like that Death Star force shield that is impenetrable. So even when victory is not possible today, says Amalek, I'm still going in. I'm going to martyr myself. I'm going to throw myself down and yell, Allahu Akbar. And if I die, I'm going to make a statement. And the statement is as follows. Number one, this is not destiny. This is happenstance. And number two, I can't get you today. But the war is eternal. So you know what? Maybe some generations from now, I'll have a grandson who'll wear a kind of a weird Hamantaschen-style hat. New? Maybe he will have more success than I do today. Okay, let's say he doesn't have success. Let's say you luck out on that holiday called Purim, and you win against my great-grandson, the guy with the Hamantash hat. Okay, then maybe skip generations forward, and there'll be some Austrian nightmarish guy named Schickelgruber, and he's going to have more success, and maybe he'll take 6 million of you down. Yeah? So this is the mindset and the vision of the enemy, Amalek. And so again, it's not a specific genetic component here. Amalek just has to simply behave like Amalek with the mindset of Amalek, and you are, for all intents and purposes, the biblical Amalek. It's not necessary to say, what are the genetics? Where do you come from? So there was a biblical Amalek. He came from Esau. But clearly that's not a prerequisite to qualify for Amalek. So the intent was to show the Jewish people it's chance. Happenstance, God doesn't really love you. Things happen. You got lucky. You're not always going to get the role of the poor, of the lottery in your favor. No. And then we also learned that who did he attack? The people that were sort of stragglers at the rear. The rabbis say maybe those people were a little deficient in their observance of the Torah, and they were subject to the nefarious attack. Okay. So it kind of told us that when you're not all together, when you're fragmented in your observance and commitment to God, that maybe the time is ripe for Amalek to attack. So look at the story with Haman, for example, the Hamantash guy. He says to King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people that are fractured, divided, scattered throughout the 127 provinces and of the king. Hey, the time is okay. The Amalek of October the 7th looked at the Jewish people all over the world in Israel, and I promise you, they were sensitive to the fracture that had breached the Jewish people at that time. No question. Now, here is a question that I want you to ponder that we're going to come back to a little later. It's a very strange oxymoron. I don't know if you caught it. Look at the last verse of Source 2. This is the biblical requirement of confronting Amalek that we read on the Shabbat, called Shabbat Zachor, before the holiday of Purim. And it says the following. Therefore it will be when the Lord your God grants you respite from all your enemies around you in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, that you shall obliterate, you shall destroy the remembrance of Amalek from beneath the heavens. You shall not forget. What? So I'm supposed to destroy the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. But don't forget. Wait a minute, which is it? Am I supposed to remember or am I supposed to extinguish their memory? You can't have it both ways. In other words, if there's no dictate to extinguish the memory, but then how do I balance that with the other dictate of not to forget? Tell me, just wipe their memory away. Don't say, well, don't forget, because by remembering, then I'm not really extinguishing their memory. Which is it? Do you see? This is it's a conundrum. It's an oxymoron. It doesn't make any sense. How could it be? So here's what I'm going to throw out to you, and I'm going to explain a little later, okay? It must be that the mechanical way that we are to destroy Amalek's remembrance, memory, is by not forgetting. Somehow, the mechanical act of memory, zichira, of zachor, to remember, is the way that you undermine and destroy everything that Amalek wishes to effect. Has to be. Okay? So let's now talk about today. 9/11. Everyone in this room, Lev is not in this room, so he gets an exception, he gets a pass. But everyone in this room, I promise you, you remember where you were on Tuesday, September the 11th, 2001. I promise you. Now, so let's think back for a moment. I personally remember I was teaching that morning in Memphis, Tennessee, and I walked into the teacher's lounge to get a drink, oblivious to anything that had happened. So it was Memphis time around 9:45 Eastern time. And this old verschlumpte color TV was on in the teacher's lounge. You know, someone had donated this ancient TV, which today probably would be $4 million on eBay. And it was just sitting there, you know, one of those ones made out of wood that weighs like 5,000 pounds. And I'm just seeing a picture of the buildings on fire. like just flames shooting out. And I'm just standing there, and there's just one other older teacher sitting there watching, and there's no conversation going on. And I just look, and I'm looking. I don't even want to understand what I'm looking at. You remember that. You probably remember hearing about a plane that hit a building. So my first thought was, okay, must be a little commuter Cessna accidentally taking off, hit a building. New? Okay, we go on. Not comprehending what had really transpired. And then the unforgettable moment of that second plane coming in to that tower. It's unforgettable. It's seared in your memory and my memory. It's unthinkable. And I remember, and I'm sure you shared the same thought process as me, you started to extrapolate what could be going on. It was a terrorist attack, of course. Mm-hmm. But you started hearing reports, because it was very sketchy at the time, that there were 20, 25, 30 other airplanes that had been unaccounted for and that were perhaps flying around as human projectile missiles somewhere. You heard something about Washington and about a Pentagon. The unknown airplane that in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, was a little bit unknown at that time. But the world, I felt like Tom Cruise's character in War of the Worlds when those giant walkers and H.G. Wells' book and movie, when they start coming, you know, and everyone just wakes up and all of a sudden they're here and they're not friendly. I felt like the world was literally coming to an end. And I couldn't even conceive of normal again. But then something amazing happened. As that day progressed, and the next, and the next, and the next, and President Bush visited, I hear you, soon they're going to hear you, and all of a sudden everyone's wearing the New York Police and Fire Department. They were the greatest superheroes in the world at that time. Do you remember that? And about 2 weeks later, all of a sudden they started to pull the video by design off of the TV. Remember that? They felt maybe it was just too much for the people to keep reliving the towers being, you know, blown up. And and things got, I wouldn't say normal, but things just got normal. You started to heal, and you kind of got back to your old job, and things sort of coming together. And yeah, there might be a war, but it would take a little while to get everything in place. It's hard to believe that the moment I just recounted for you actually happened. Just like I'm sure if I could just go back to the COVID when you heard that the synagogue is closed and you got to stay in your house. It's only 3-4 years ago. You're thinking, did we really go through this? We did. So how did this happen? How did we go from a moment of Pearl Harbor times whatever, but it was done in a visual medium, unlike Pearl Harbor, right? Other than Torah, Torah, Torah. When did that movie come out, by the way? It was a long time after Pearl Harbor, right? So, right. So we never saw the visuals, the way it was seared into your memory, and yet we got over it, didn't we? We went on with daily life. We went on. Why? How is that possible? So here, I believe, is the root of the issue of memory. Now, I think it's entirely human and normal for us to go on from tragedy. I'll prove it to you. When Jacob is given the Technicolor Dreamcoat torn to pieces, and he's shown this evidence of Joseph's demise, it says, "Vayima'ein lehisnachem." He refuses to be comforted. And for 22 dark years, Jacob can't get over the loss of Joseph. And Rashi there says, well, why? Why does he refuse comfort? Because God only gets a person over their shock and awe and the tragedy if the person in question is actually dead. But if the person in question is actually alive but thought to be dead, and that's the horror of a captive, that's the horror of a hostage, that we don't know, then God can't heal. Because part of the process of healing is the 12 months of mourning and the gradual re-emergence of the mourner, the avel, into society, into the norms. You get up from Shiva, you get up from 30 or 12 months of mourning, and you re-emerge, and you go forward. But Jacob was denied this because Joseph's not dead. So it's human for us to leave 9/11 behind and get up from the grief and the shock and the mourning and the loss and to actually live life again. Because what choice do you have? October 7th was our Jewish 9/11. Very real. And yet, in the 11 months, we've been able to go on. Our brothers and sisters in Israel, not so much. But we've gotten up from the morning and we've lived life again. It doesn't mean we don't think about it. We don't pray. We don't have feelings. Of course, we're human. But it's entirely a human function that is actually a gift from God that we have the ability to get up from the grief and to live. So that means that what we feel 23 years later about 9/11 is kind of, I don't want to say a distant memory, but it's a distant memory. And even October 7th now, for us, is something in the past. It's present because of a war and other issues, and the hostages still not being reunited with their families, so there's still that uncertainty, yes, of Israel. But in many ways, people turn the page and they go on, and it's okay. Don't beat yourself up if that is you or if that is me, because it's reality. God has hardwired that into the nature, the fabric of who we are. So let us discuss for a moment then. How do we approach the idea of balancing memory with the fleeting inspiration of the moment? Because I promise you, on September the 12th, or on October the 8th of last year, you vowed to yourself that you would never be the same human being again, that you would do something different, that you were inspired to help in any way you could, to donate, to give of yourself. It's who you are. It's who I am. And yet that inspiration is fleeting. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, the great Mir Rosh Hashiva, says, how do you maintain that fleeting inspiration? How do you do it? So there was a very famous man. His name was Palti Ben Laish. He was not so famous, but I've made him famous. And Rabbi Shmulevitz has made him famous. Now, who was Palti? Palti worked, and he was a trusted advisor to King Saul, the first king of the Jewish people. So Palti was given the princess, King Saul's daughter, Michal, as his bride. Here's the beautiful princess. You guys are going to get married, said King Saul. You're going to live a happy life together. Everything was great except for one small issue. She was a married woman. She was given by King Saul to King David when he defeated Goliath. That was one of his rewards. Of course, she fell in love and he fell in love and they had a beautiful marriage. The problem was, in the darkness of King Saul's mind, he delegitimized that marriage of his princess Michal to David because he really resented and hated David at that point during the darkness of his soul. And therefore, he said to Palti, hey, I'm the greatest rabbi of the generation. I'm the king. And I don't think there ever was a valid Jewish marriage. Never happened. Michal is not a married woman. She's yours. And of course, poor Palti is like, ooh. But he knew, Palti did, that David is legitimately married to Princess Michal. He can't touch her. But to go against the king would be to lose his head. So they went through with the marriage. And the wedding night happens. And Palti is alone with Michal, the beautiful princess. And what happens? Nothing happens. Because Palti, sort of like Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, you shall not pass. Okay, if you don't know this scene, it's a great scene. So, does anyone here know that reference? Okay, fine. Thank you. Is it not a great moment of the great Sir Ian McKellen? Yes, thank you. Palti jumps up in the marriage bed and he pulls out his knight's sword and he plunges it through the bed in the middle and he says, no one shall pass this sword by the point of death. We will stay apart, Princess Michal. And they stay apart. And it goes on for a day, for a night, and another day, and another night. And it goes on for months and even years. No hanky-panky between Palti and Princess Michal. And the rabbis say, oh my gosh, you know, Boaz had one night of temptation with Ruth, and he's given tremendous credit for being this big tzaddik, a righteous man. This poor guy, Palti, had potentially months and even years of, I'm with a beautiful woman, we're alone, and she's my wife, and I have what's called a yetzahara, an inclination. So how did he overcome that? How does a sword plunge through a bed in a moment of inspiration help him? Well, you know how it helps? Because it's not the sword. The sword's meaningless. You just take the sword out and I have the woman. No. When Palti had a desire, he looks at that sword and he's propelled retroactively back in time to that moment of inspiration. And in that moment of inspiration, he doesn't touch her. So that is what we need to do to countermand the getting over 9/11 or October 7th. You need to do something tactile, real, to affect change. In Palti's case, it was the sword. I wouldn't recommend that for everyone. But you need to choose your own sword of Palti. We all do. And when you are inspired in the moment, don't let the moment wane. Keep the moment by doing something and changing yourself. Take something upon yourself. I will not be the same person that I was, because as a response to 9/11 and to those we lost, as a response to 8/7 and who we lost last October 7th, I'm not the same person. So what does that mean for us? It means, as we said, memory. And memory is the tool, the mechanical way we can undermine everything that Amalek, everything that Hamas, everything that Osama bin Laden, they're all the same. What did they try to do? They tried to tell us and show us and demonstrate for us very vividly that you are vulnerable. You're not alone. I can touch you and make you feel unsafe. And we felt very insecure and very unsafe. And it's not just, can you imagine how we put up with all that TSA stuff? Did anyone try to fly, by the way, about a month after 9/11? I will never forget. The TSA didn't even know. They didn't even exist. So they didn't know which end was up. So they started, I remember I'm going to New York 2 weeks after, literally 2 weeks after 9/11. The planes were flying again. And I needed to get to New York. And they didn't even know at Memphis Airport what to do. So we are wait, you know, we go through the normal procedure. And then they had like a random screening there by the airplane, you know, as we got on the airplane. And we're all there. And there was a guy who could be Osama bin Laden's cousin. And he's sitting like right over there. And I'm thinking to myself, I just looked around and I'm thinking, I'm totally okay if you take me off and give me the ninth degree. But the rest of us said, if you don't search Osama, we said to the guy, if Osama doesn't get the third degree, we're all okay with the third degree, but if he doesn't get the third degree, but if you give it to Granny, then we're not getting on the airplane. And sure enough, Osama's cousin got the third degree, and it worked, okay? But it was like we didn't know which end was up. So I ask you now, if you go back in your mind, there was a point of inspiration that you had and that I had. There was a point last Simchat Torah Shmini Atzeret, where we were all inspired to do something. The way to combat Amalek, the way to combat what they tried to do, is to never forget. By never forgetting, we're saying the following. Effecting change, something tactile that will bring us forward and that will give meaning, purpose to ourselves and to those we lost. The Palti bin Laish sword. So we promised at the beginning to talk a little bit about that mindset. So now let's just recap very briefly. We've explored the differences between the different segments of the Torah, how the last book of the Torah is sort of an editorial slant from the point of view of God on what things mean in our world. We discussed the purpose behind Amalek and their original attack, how they tried to give us a sense of you're not alone and things are coincidental. Things are by happenstance, and we as Jewish people believe in destiny. And then we explore the nature of zikhir, of memory itself, to not forget. And we ask the question, how can it be that I'm required to eradicate their memory, but at the same time you tell me not to forget? And I promised you that we would explain, so I think we have explained. The way to imbue meaning and purpose into loss is to do something real with memory. Because memory means what to others? Significance. That the events that happened are not by chance. They're not random. They're not happenstance. They are by design. And if we will ascribe meaning to the events of present and the past, that is the greatest single way that we can destroy the Amalek of our world. Because what does a terrorist want to do at this? Think about it for a moment. When a terrorist attacks, when Amalek attacked us, when they committed martyrdom by running into the clouds of glory and throwing themselves at God in defiance, what were they trying to do? Essentially tell us, you Jewish people, I can't get you today, but there will come a time where you will be subject to my evil machinations. And they were correct. So our response has to be something tactile. So I think today on 9/11, we need to resensitize ourselves. We need to come to terms again with the past, to incorporate that with who we are now and going forward. And this is a Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur message, because we're all going to get inspired. God willing, you'll go to shul, you'll go to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and you'll leave Yom Kippur. And as you're waiting for that bagels, lox, and cream cheese sandwich, 30 seconds after Yom Kippur is over, you'll say, oh, I remember Kaplan talking about this moment. Wow. Have the first bite, and then you're not hungry anymore. By the way, do you ever notice this? As soon as you break your fast, you're like, what was I fixating on for 25 hours? Okay, but be that as it may, you'll remember this moment. How do I integrate the experience of the inspiration of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur to make it something that is not fleeting? And again, something very simple. Just choose a little something. Change something in your life. You'll pray a little better. You'll pray more often. You'll say a little psalm here. Whatever it is, you'll be nicer to people. You'll make an effort every day to do one little smile at a stranger. Whatever you choose, what greater way to incorporate the moment, the Palti Ben Laish sword, and it doesn't have to be something grandiose, I promise you. So my hope, my prayer for all of us, for our world, is that we never forget, and that the zechira, the commandment of memory, is something that we can at least offer when we can't offer anything else. We can't enlist in the IDF and fight for Israel right now. I think most of us are not quite up to that. But what we can do is imbue purpose and memory in the moment. In 9/11, in Shmini Atzeret war, in what's going on now in Israel. And it's a unique opportunity coming up where we have Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur to reinvent ourselves and to approach a new year with new beginnings and new things that we can get. So please, God, we will all have that intestinal fortitude and the inspirational moment. And when that moment comes, please, 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 think of the poor Palti Ben Laish. Think of that moment and think of what you are capable of and do something and make it your own. So I wish everyone a wonderful evening. We look forward to many, many more learning sessions.